Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
This podcast exists because of paid members at decodingtv.com. If you go to decodingtv.com, you can sign up to be a paid member and get ad-free episodes of our podcasts, including of Decoding TV and A Cast of Kings. You can get early access to episodes and exclusive bonus episodes that we'll make just for you. Thanks to everyone at DecodingTV.com who makes this podcast possible.
I know you killed two corpus at Morlana One, and I know they're coming for you. So you flex out your ways to let them have you. Waste of talent. Who are you? That's the wrong question. The right question is, how much time do we have to get out of here?
Why would I go anywhere with you?
Don't you want to fight these bastards for?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV. I am David Chen.
And I'm Patrick Willems.
On today's episode of Decoding TV, we're going to be recapping and reviewing Season 1, Episodes 1 through 3 of the new Disney Plus series, Andor. We are not going to spoil anything from any future episodes. That includes anything on the next time on preview, but we will be spoiling everything through Episodes 1 through 3. And I'm really excited to dive into the show with Patrick H. Willems. We just announced earlier this week that we would be recapping the show on the Decoding TV podcast. We're really excited to have you here. I do want to point out that you can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. That's for the audio version. Or you can watch it on youtube.com/decodingtv. You can also email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. I'm sure we're going to get a lot of feedback throughout the course of the season. We'll probably discuss it on the show. So before we get to the episodes, though, Patrick,
yes.
Probably a couple things we should cover at the beginning of this conversation.
Okay.
One is we released our first recap preview episode a couple days ago, in which you and I reviewed and revisited the Gareth Edwards movie Rogue One.
A Star Wars story.
And during that conversation, let's just say I've gotten a lot of texts and tweets about our comments about the final Darth Vader sequence.
You had texts? As in your friends were so concerned about things we said on a podcast that they had to text you about
yes.
them.
They're like, David, I'm worried about your safety and sanity because of these comments that you made. Now, to recap what our comments were, Patrick said something along the lines of, you know, the very final scene of Rogue One where you see Darth Vader there, is a perfect example of what is wrong with current day Star Wars storytelling, that it is kind of a higher, better CG version of what we've seen before. And it doesn't contribute anything to that story that they were telling right there. Now, there was some pushback to this that I think actually I wanted to present to you and see what you thought. But like the one piece of pushback that I thought was like actually pretty convincing
okay.
is that final sequence in Rogue One is about Darth Vader being a badass, and it looks cool. And, you know, I think that's part of our problem with it is, like, it's too much about that. But it could also be construed to be equally about the fear, the pain, the sacrifice of all the people who are, like, bringing that disc with the plans, you know, and handing it off in a relay race style thing to get them off the ship. And that does, in fact, tie in with the rest of the themes of Rogue One, which are about sacrifice and what people are willing to do for a greater good. So I did think, I guess it does kind of tie in with some of the themes. It's not completely just unrelated. It's not like super rich, you know, because you don't know any of these people, right? But at the same time, it's not completely disconnected from the rest of the film in the way that I think you and I might have implied. What say you, Patrick Willems?
I mean, that is true that it does, you know, it does showcase rebels sacrificing their lives to get this message, this information, these plans, you know, to their destination, which is what the whole movie has been about. The movie is about sacrifice. The main all of the heroes of the movie do die in the end. And that said, I still think I think it's a pretty well-directed scene. It is, it's fun, like, on its own, like, isolated from the rest of the movie. It's a fun little clip to be like, oh, wow, here's Darth Vader being really scary. Oh, wow, here's, you know, what it must be like to be a regular person going up against Darth Vader at the height of his powers and everything. I still think Darth Vader's mere presence in the movie feels like a tacked on piece of fan service, mm-hmm. as if they didn't have enough confidence. Again, this is, and we'll get into this in the episode, but Andor, the show, is in many ways what I really wish Rogue One had been, which is having the confidence to tell a story within the Star Wars universe without feeling the need to push in these like really familiar, popular elements to appease the fans. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's what Darth Vader in Rogue One largely is. It's just like, oh, this movie's kind of risky because it's about new characters. So let's put a couple scenes of Darth Vader being cool in there to make people happy. And I still think it feels I still just think it's unnecessary and indulgent, even if it does like tonally
mm-hmm.
fit in with the movie that we've been watching up to that point.
Well, listener, I tried my best. I will say that I think you're right that like it feels kind of like Darth Vader doesn't need to be in the movie. You could have a whole fine movie without Darth Vader, and also it would have been nice to not have a Skywalker or someone from the Skywalker bloodline in the movie as a significant role.
We came however, so close.
However, Rogue One is about the Death Star, and that is a thing that we've seen before. You know, that is the primary thing that Rogue One is about. So, anyway. I had to give it a shot. Okay.
Totally fine. And look, it is literally impossible to voice any opinion on Star Wars at all without getting some kind of pushback. There is mm-hmm. no uncontroversial opinion about Star Wars, except for maybe I think Empire Strikes Back is a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so, look, if people have problems with things I say about, you know, George Lucas's space stories, bring it on.
I wanted to mention this Rolling Stone piece that was published this week. This was a piece by Brian Hyatt entitled Inside the Making of Andor, the Star Wars series that changes everything. What I'm about to read may be considered a very minor spoiler. I don't really consider it a spoiler, but if you're really wanting to stay spoiler-free, then just skip the next minute or so. But I thought that some of this stuff was interesting about how the show was made. Quote, Lucasfilm's original concept was for Andor to be a 5-season show with each 12-episode season covering a year in the story. And both Tony Gilroy and Diego Luna initially signed on for that enormous commitment. Said Luna, I realize how much I missed this job and missed this character. But around the time they were shooting the show's 5th and 6th episodes in Scotland, the duo sat down, had some drinks, and decided they had agreed to an impossible plan. At the rate it was taking to make the show, 5 seasons would have turned out to be a commitment of 15 years. It was just like, we can't possibly do this, Gilroy said. It's a massive, massive undertaking, and Diego wouldn't be able to play a younger man over the next 15 years. We wouldn't be able to physically do it, and we were like, oh my God, what are we going to do? So at first it was desperation, and then a very lucky, elegant solution presented itself. And the solution was to push against the draw-it-out imperative of ultra-serialized storytelling in the streaming era. With Lucasfilm's permission, they decided to drastically speed up the pace and turn the show into a 24-episode limited series. Andor's first season, which covers a year's worth of events, was already broken up into 3-episode blocks, each block held by a single director. For season 2, which begins production in November, each 3-episode block will cover 1 year, end quote. So that is a plan for Andor. It's interesting to conceive of it as like, oh, wow, it was almost a 15-year commitment that lasted 5 seasons, and now it's only going to be 2 years.
It really would be wild to like, I think they made the right choice there because as much as obviously within the Star Wars timeline, this period, the, you know, period between episodes 3 and 4 is like a very fertile ground for stories. There's, you know, a lot going on. It's like the Empire at its height. But also, that's especially for Diego Luna, who I just looked it up earlier, is currently 42, asking him to play younger than he currently is for like a decade plus is like, it's a big ask. And
I mean, that to me is the least problematic issue, because my response to that is Better Call Saul. Basically, Better Call Saul takes place before the events of Breaking Bad, and literally everyone's like decades older in that show, and it was fine. Like, there was no problems.
That's a very good point. I retract my statement.
But I can understand they're just like, hey, we're freaking exhausted after like working on this for 5 episodes. We cannot do another 50 episodes of this.
I mean, you know, Tony Gilroy is in his 60s.
Yeah.
Like, he's if they did that, it's like, okay, so this is basically everything he does for the remainder of his career.
Mm-hmm.
That's like it. Yeah.
He would be pulling a James Cameron Avatar, basically, if he
did,
does he want to dedicate the rest of his career to Andor and Star Wars? Probably not.
I know. I will say, did you read from like maybe a week or so ago the New York Times interview with Gilroy?
Yeah, you mentioned it on our last episode. Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at it again today, and I think that I think is really interesting relating to the genesis of Andor is the fact that they went through a couple versions of the show without Gilroy involved. That's interesting to think about, because apparently they wanted to make a Cassian Andor show, which I think is an interesting thing in the first place, because he's like, as we did a whole episode on Rogue One, but I think Andor, like a lot of the characters in that movie, they have a really good actor who's like fun to watch. They have a really compelling beginning of a character, but they don't really get around to like fully fleshing that character out. Andor in Rogue One, I'm like, oh, this person seems kind of cool, but it's not like he doesn't. Do you know what I mean? I'm not immediately like, oh my God, I need to know everything about where this character came from.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yet they were set on making – it wasn't like Gilroy came in like while working on it and was like, you know, I'd love to do more with this. Gilroy was done, but Lucasfilm was like, we want more Andor. And they commissioned a pilot script and then just happened to show it to Tony Gilroy. And then he gave notes on it. And what he said was, I found the memo from 4 years ago where I basically said, it's Cassian and K2SO storming the Citadel. I don't think you can do that for 20 episodes. So I wrote a whole manifesto in some manic blitz. I said, this is the show you should do. I sent it to Kathy Kennedy. And it was like, okay, well, we're not doing that. They tried another approach. When that fell apart, they read this memo over again, and suddenly what seemed insane 2 years earlier was starting to look good. That memo
two
is the
years
show
earlier. We- 2 years earlier, a key statement there. Like they had tried for 2 years and couldn't figure out an approach that worked.
Right. Presumably, it seems like they wrote two other pilot scripts and with other people, and then finally just came back to Tony Gilroy. And all this time passes of him, you know, having no intention of he just like threw out ideas. He was like, if you make the show, here's what might be a fun idea. And what I think is also interesting is looking at the timeline of this. I feel like a lot of this was happening during the time when Lucasfilm was maybe having trouble with other projects and like, you know, replacing filmmakers and stuff like that. There's a lot of turnover there. And it's interesting because, you know, famously, the only Disney era Star Wars movie to have an untroubled production was The Last Jedi. Everything else had some kind of turmoil there. And it seemed like at least from the from the perspective of a lot of like people like us, it seemed like, man, Lucasfilm really seems to be having trouble like letting these filmmakers they hire, like, because they're hiring interesting people, but like letting them commit to their vision and do the thing that they were hired to do without micromanaging or replacing them with other people. And it's interesting to me that eventually they finally came back to Tony Gilroy and were just like, you know what, we're just going to give you basically, it seems like kind of carte blanche to just fully spend multiple years making whatever you want to make, and we're not going to get in your way.
And we're all richer for it.
It's
but
true.
Yeah, let's talk about whether we are richer for it, you know? Andor, episodes 1-3. Let's talk about overall thoughts.
Yes.
What did you think of Andor episodes 1-3? And then what we're going to do for the rest of this episode is we're going to talk about each individual character's plot line. We'll take a quick break, and then we're going to talk about episode 3 as an independent unit, because I think there's a lot of stuff that happens in episode 3 that's awesome.
That's true.
But let's talk about overall thoughts first, Patrick Willems. What did you think?
Overall thoughts, I am a fan of the television series Andor. As someone who has been very mixed and mostly lukewarm at best on the Disney Plus Star Wars shows, the live action ones. Andor is kind of what I have wanted them all to be. This is so far, just from the first three episodes, I think it is much more satisfying. And just enjoy it. Like I'm genuinely really enjoying the show, and it's doing stuff with Star Wars that I'd kind of assumed they weren't going to do. We talked about this on our Rogue One episode, but it seemed like Star Wars was mostly interested in just kind of like replaying greatest hits, rehashing like stuff we've seen before, giving just like a lot of like just playing with the old toys, giving a lot of fan service moments, Boba Fett riding rancors and stuff like that. Just going back to Tatooine again and again and again and again. So far in Andor, in the first three episodes, no Tatooine.
No, not even no Tatooine. No desert planets that play a significant role as far as
right.
I can tell.
I mean, so. The place where Cassian lives is kind of barren, but it's like... It's wet. There's mud.
Yeah.
There's also trees. No desert planet, which is great. But it is a Star Wars show that does not seem remotely interested in fan service, that is not cramming in cameos from like beloved minor characters. It's doing what I've always wanted, at least so far, which is it's just telling a story that happens to be set in the Star Wars universe that is not all about Star Wars. And we'll get into this in more detail, but it's also doing a thing that I've really wanted to see for a very long time, which is spending a lot of time just showing the lives of pretty ordinary people in this galaxy, people who have jobs and like adult relationships and stuff like that. People who aren't the leaders of rebellions or royalty or chosen ones or bounty hunters, just fairly ordinary people. And I think it feels genuinely fresh and unique compared to, I mean, maybe all the Star Wars ever. I'm not saying this is like a miracle and the greatest show I've ever seen, but I think it's genuinely good, and I'm really hooked and having a great time so far.
Agreed with pretty much every single thing you said. I think that what is exciting to me about a show like Andor is all the stuff you said. It's like there's no lightsabers, there's no Tatooine, there's no Force, right? For some people, they're like, well, why would you want to watch it then? Like, why would you want to watch that as a Star Wars thing? And it's my reaction is it's a big universe that Star Wars introduces to you, starting with episode 4, right? It's a huge, all this stuff that's happening. And it's like, what if we just zoomed in on a tiny corner of that and like explored interesting stories there? That's what I want. I don't want anything that has anything to do with Luke Skywalker and the Skywalker bloodline anymore.
David, can I jump in and read one quote from Gilroy that I think is so says a lot?
Sure.
It was from this New York Times interview from last week where he says, I remember having a conversation with Kathy Kennedy and she said, we can do anything. I would say, what do you mean by anything? If I wanted to do Inherit the Wind in Star Wars, could I do that? And my God, we could. We could do a hospital show in Star Wars. How many beings exist in that galaxy? All those plumbers and farmers and anesthesiologists, they all have lives. And that is something that I've, like, for instance, I think that I would always say, like, semi-joking but kind of serious to my friends when they announced the Obi-Wan show, which is, like, I would just say, I hope the whole show is just him hanging out at, like, the pod racing track with a bunch of losers, like, every episode, and just, like, a slice of life kind of thing. And this Andor so far is, like, closer to that than I would have expected.
Yeah, and I would say that I don't think Marvel has done quite what Tony Gilroy just described, you know, but it's come closer to it than Star Wars has, right? Marvel, I feel like, you know, yes, most origin story movies are, like, pretty similar, but, like, at least there's, like, a little bit more variety in there than I feel like there has been in Star Wars. I do want to say that a lot of people did reach out after our last episode and said, hey, you should check out The Bad Batch animated show, like, that's really strong. And also Visions, right? Basically the non-live action stuff has been really strong from Star Wars perspective. So I do want to note that it's not like Star Wars hasn't done that kind of exploration or interesting explorations at all. But I agree with you that getting a sense of what these other characters are like completely beyond the scope of our main story is more interesting to me at this stage of my life. It may not be for you who's listening or watching this, but it is for me. Now, of course, ironically, like, Andor is a prequel series to Rogue One, which itself is a prequel to Star Wars Episode IV. So it's not, like, completely separated, right? There are going to be elements, and there's characters, as we've seen in the posters, that will be in future episodes of Andor, and that will tie into what we already know. But so far, I agree, episodes 1-3 feel really fresh. And to feel like this series will be satisfying in its own right, completely separate from any knowledge you might have about Star Wars. That I don't know if that's going to be true by the episode 12. Like, maybe Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker are going to show up and it's going to be like, oh, okay, well, guess we're back there again. But as of right now, it looks like they're telling a completely different kind of story, and I'm really excited about it.
As in, there have been some, I'll just say, very stupid complaints on the internet about the lack of Easter eggs in this show. And which is one of the most depressing things I think I've ever heard anyone say about, like, film or cinema or at all. Just the idea that people have become so conditioned to watch things specifically to look for references to other things, as if it's like a looking at them as basically a puzzle instead of like a piece of narrative art, is just it's bleak. That's a bleak opinion, and I feel the opposite about it. I really enjoy watching a Star Wars thing that is not designed to make me just do the Leo pointing meme every 5 minutes.
It is really bleak, and unfortunately, I think it's a very dominant part of the discourse today. You know, a lot of people, I think of art as a puzzle to be solved or as a set of Easter eggs to be discovered, as opposed to a narrative to be enjoyed in its own right. And that's a bummer, I think. And I'm glad that Andor is bucking that trend and saying we're not concerned with any of that stuff. So before we get even, I know this has been the longest preamble possible, but before we even get into the main episodes themselves, there's a couple of meta elements to the episodes that we should just mention real quick. Andor has like a title sequence. Just thought I'd throw it out there. I thought, you know, it's kind of cool, like the title coming into folding in from space and so on, and the logo and such.
It looks like there's a planet, and then no, it's the symbol.
Yeah, yeah.
And you also get some nice haunting Nicholas Britell strings over that little title sequence.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not, you know, not quite the banger that his Succession theme song is, but it's a striking little melody at the beginning.
He did some great work in episodes 1-3, Nicholas Britell, the composer. We start the show, episode 1, on Morlana 1, which is also entitled, it also has the words Preox Morlana Corporate Zone in the opening credits. And I love they just throw you in. They don't even explain what any of this is. And we're going to talk about Andor's storyline in the first two episodes. Andor shows up at...
Do you want to say it's also BBY5?
BBY5. What is BBY5, Patrick?
I believe it stands for Before the Battle of Yavin, 5 years.
Got it.
Which is... I'm curious if this is like a term used within the galaxy. Is it if everyone looks at the Battle of Yavin as basically such a major event that it's like a turning point in the entire... Like,
right.
History?
You divide history into before the Battle of Yavin to after the Battle of Yavin? Yeah.
Right.
Interesting.
And, or if it's just, like, a helpful thing for the audience's sake, mm-hmm. like, 5 years before that.
Well, if it's trying to be helpful to the audience, as a newcomer to Star Wars live action shows, relatively, it wasn't helpful, because I was like, what is that?
Also, to be clear, I what I just told you, I read that on the internet. I did not, okay. I did not watch the episode and be like, ah, yes, I know what this means.
So there is this kind of Blade Runner-y universe or world that Andor arrives on, and he kind of takes this big walk down the street, and he shows up at this, let's say, nightclub?
I would say it's a brothel.
Hmm. Is that? I don't think that's ever explicit, though, Patrick. Like, you don't know what they're going back there to do. Maybe they're taken back there, and they take the dudes back there, and they play some video games. You know, you don't know what's going on.
You know, that is true. but based on the demeanor of the woman with the really, I feel like we should have like the cast list,
yes.
And her name is right here, but
yes.
The woman who Andor speaks with, who has an amazing look with, hair with intensely horizontal hair, again, Star Wars tends to give people cool, striking appearances, and she just looks really cool. But based on how friendly she is with him and the other people they're complaining about, like, not being served, it strikes me as some kind of brothel. Which also, assuming
the actor, by the way, is Margaret Clooney, who plays that person in the space brothel, allegedly.
Yeah. Does she have a character name?
I think it's just called Hostess.
Okay.
But I'm not sure.
But I will say, if it is a brothel, as I believe it is, that is new territory for Star Wars,
yeah.
As far as I am aware, which is, I feel like kind of an early signal that this is going to, while not being like an HBO show, it's like a little more mature than previous Star Wars.
I believe it was your colleague, Adam Lance Garcia, that pointed out that this is the first Star Wars property that has used the S word in it. Is that
it
right?
It is. Yes. I sat up when that happened. I was like, that is a word that I've never heard in, at least in live action Star Wars.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it only it is said once. They do say bastard several times.
Mm. So a lot of ground being broken in the Star Wars universe left and right. All right. So the reason Andor is there is because he's looking for his sister, who he grew up with in Canary, and we see that in flashbacks. But she's not there. They can't find her. No one uses the real name there. So he kind of leaves empty-handed without really that much of a lead, as far as I can tell. But the two sentry guards there are really angry at Andor that he got to see a hostess first. And so they try to shake him down outside of the place. And
they also don't like the way he's looking at them. And mm-hmm. they have a problem with his whole vibe.
Yeah. Yes. And there is actually a really brilliant sequence when he's kind of like they're kind of approaching him from behind. And the frame kind of stays on Andor's face for a really long time. And I think you're meant to kind of try to understand all the emotions roiling underneath the surface under Andor. Like, what should he do? All the calculations he's making. He essentially reluctantly kills both dudes.
I think he accidentally kills the first one.
He accidentally kills the first one. And then he realizes, oh, there's no way, you know, to quote Al Pacino in Heat, why, once you are at murder one, why leave a living witness, right? So he knows that it's better off for him if he just kills both of them.
And I will say, I think this is a really effectively done sequence when the first guy who's like, when he's like on his knees on the ground is like genuinely like freaked out and scared and sad when realizing that the other guy is dead. And then, and it really holds on Andor for a long time, as you can see him like before he shoots the guy, as he's like calculating like all his options, like potential outcomes, until he finally makes the decision. This is now our second introduction to Cassian Andor in the dark alley killing a person, just like he is in Rogue One. In Rogue One, he does it pretty quickly, as if
he like barely hesitates in Rogue One.
Exactly. In this,
it's cold-blooded in Rogue One.
In this, there's a lot of hesitation as he has to think through it and then finally arrives at that decision. And so, again, you can see, the character development that we have to go through over the course of these two seasons.
And that's kind of, the show is planting its flag, I think, with this scene and basically saying like, okay, you saw him at the beginning of Rogue One, you saw him at the beginning of this show, like this series, Andor, is going to take you from this character who doesn't know how to handle himself, like probably could have gotten out of this situation if he was like older and wiser, from this guy who's reluctantly defending himself to cold-blooded murdering on behalf of the rebellion. Like that's the arc of the show, and I'm here for it. That's a good arc. I'm interested in where that's going to go. Okay.
Also, I just want to say, this city looks awesome. Just like these back streets and everything, these like sort of like plexiglass kind of like pods in the walls with people in them. There's like a hologram alien dancer in the brothel / nightclub, whatever. It's just, I mean, we've come to expect like a pretty high level of production design and visuals from modern era Star Wars. They have a really amazing team designing all of this stuff. And I just, I really like the look of this place that is again, called Morlana Corporate Zone.
Yeah. And that's one of the most interesting things about the show, I think, is that it's about occupied territories, and the places that are occupied are largely administered by corporations or a corporation, as opposed to like the military arm of the empire or whatever. And I think definitely a lot of like shades of the Iraq War, I would say, in the story, and the use of private contractors in war and things of that nature. So I'm kind of curious like what the show is going to say about that. I think it probably will have something to say about it, which really interests me. All right. So obviously this creates a lot of problems for Andor, but he goes back to Ferrix and meets his friend, a woman mechanic / inventory specialist, I wrote in my notes, but her name is Bix.
Wait, you're not going to talk about everyone's favorite droid?
Sorry. I should say he kind of wakes up at with B2 EMO, right?
Yeah.
Which is, I got to say, I got some real TARS from Interstellar flashback.
We all love TARS.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. But it's kind of like this kind of, it's kind of the same cadence of tone, like the same voice quality and cadence of tone as TARS. And also like both TARS in Interstellar and B2 EMO are like these run down kind of broken, barely functional, it feels like they're barely functional robots. But yes, we do meet his robot friend.
He's a little blocky red guy.
Yeah.
Just, you know, Star Wars has consistently been great at droid designs. And I think this is another really cool one. And it also, you know, and it's the kind of droid that probably not a top of the line droid. It's what they could afford.
Well, we later learn it's like decades old. Because I think we see B2AMO in a flashback when he's picked up, right? So, speaking of flashbacks, maybe we should talk about the flashback now, because like when he kind of wakes, before he wakes up on Ferrix, Andor has a flashback of when he was a child. And there's a whole sequence of flashbacks we see throughout the episode, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, throughout the three episodes.
And it shows him kind of with a bunch of other kids on Canary, which is, we later learn, is an abandoned Imperial mining planet
where there was some kind of mining disaster, and apparently after that the Empire left it behind. And so, and I'm curious about this, he lives with like a band of kids, and I'm wondering, were there parents killed right. in the mining disaster, and then they ended up kind of forming their own little community, because the clothing that they're wearing seems like it was kind of made from, like,
yeah, harvested. Yeah.
Exactly. They're not making clothing out of like leaves and stuff. It's like these were like, yeah, these were actual like manufactured, like, you know, clothing items that they've now kind of like refashioned and all of that. But he seems to live with this just, you know, gang of kids in the woods, just other teens. And a really interesting thing about this is also is all of these sequences, they speak a different language. They're not speaking basic, which is, of course, what they call English in Star Wars. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But none of it's subtitled.
Yeah, I was surprised at that. It was interesting. I watched the show on screeners, and I was like, are the screeners missing the subtitles? You know, like, but no. When the final episodes came out, no subtitles. I was like, are the screeners malfunctioning? There's no subtitles on it. But yeah, really interesting decision to not have any subtitles on what they're saying.
Yeah, and you can figure it all out, and you know, like it's very easy to follow. You can figure out like, oh, here's his sister, and he seems to be called Casa, mm-hmm. Not Cassian, on that world. And also in the Rolling Stone piece, they mentioned that this was, I don't think it was entirely to explain this, but this also gives an in-universe origin for Diego Luna's accent and why, yeah. You know, because he is from Mexico in the real world and the rest of the cast is not. It's largely Americans and Brits.
Yeah,
and so putting him on this other planet makes sense. He has a different accent than everyone else.
Yeah, I thought all the other stuff on that planet was really interesting. I was just like, wow, I've never really seen anything like this before, you know. And then when this ship crashes, mm-hmm. I guess it's an Imperial ship, is my sense, right?
This is a thing that I'm also interested in, because yeah. the uniforms that the people on the ship are wearing don't seem to be like traditional Imperial uniforms, and also yeah. the people on there mostly seem to have like yellow skin,
mm-hmm.
and seem to as if they're from like a specific alien race. And so it could be Imperial, because a lot of things are in this yeah. world, in this part of the timeline, because this would presumably be maybe like 15 years ago or so.
First of all, I don't think the yellowed skin, I believe, is due to like poison that was released or some okay. poison or something. Yeah. But yeah, it could be. And I think our sense is that the mining disaster happened before the events of the flashbacks.
Yes. Seen, right? Yes.
Yeah. So a big like, mining disaster happened. And then like maybe someone went back down to like do reconnaissance in the ship. Something went wrong with the ship right. or something like that.
Those right? kids look like they've been there for a while, like living in the woods.
Because the thing is, Marva, when she shows up later, is like, hey, like there's an Imperial frigate on the way. So I assume it's an Imperial ship, you know, as to why. But anyway.
It makes sense. Marva being Fiona Shaw's character, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I loved all that stuff with the kids kind of approaching the ship. Like they have like a plan. They're like organized, you know, they have like a plan of attack. I was like heartbroken when that one of the lead child got shot by the guy that woke up, and then like yeah. all the kids descend on that guy, and it's like a really scary
with their sequence. Blow darts,
right? Yeah, yeah, they have blow darts like ready to go, and right. they put like 18 blow darts into the guy. It's really like a harrowing sequence.
It
like,
is,
really well
and
done.
And also we, I mean, it seems like these kids lived in like a more advanced civilization, and then ended up kind of, you know, like moving to the woods after the mining disaster. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of, from what I can recall, other than the Ewoks, have we really seen many like indigenous people like living in this kind of society in mm-hmm. Star Wars? I mean, maybe
you would know more than me, but yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Tusken Raiders a little bit, yeah. but it's very rare to see people, you know, people in Star Wars living in like tents in the woods.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And really covered in dirt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So young Cassian decides to stay behind, even as like the rest of the kids kind of get out of there, goes to investigate the ship, starts smashing, like sees himself in a mirror. And then that was a cool moment too, because he's like, oh, he probably, there's no mirrors where they are probably. So
right.
it's interesting to see himself reflected in a piece of technology. Then he starts smashing everything. And I assume that that was because he was upset that they had killed his friend, but I didn't mm-hmm. know what your interpretation of that was.
That was how I took it as well. Yeah. I didn't read it as he hates the little face paint stripe he drew on his chin so much that he's just gonna throw a fit about it. Yeah, I assumed it was just because
yeah.
it kind of I mean, you know, honestly, there's like a lot of things that could have potentially triggered that. He seems to, you know, be living a difficult life. But yeah, he does start smashing up the place, which is when I believe that's when the other characters show up, right?
Yeah, Marva and her buddy, and they are clearly, I think, scavenging the ship for like energy cores or what have you. And mm-hmm. so they show up, they get there. And then she's like, I'm not going to leave this kid behind to die because there's all these dead people outside. They're going to blame the kid. They're going to enslave him. They're going to kill him, whatever. So she just kind of hastily takes him. And I mean, that whole sequence is awesome, too. I mean, it happens in episode 3, but her friend says to her, hey, like, you better think about this. And she's like, oh, there's going to be plenty of time for that. And, you know, like, it kind of knocks him out, like gives him some kind of injection, and then like takes her with him. And then you as the viewer, you're like filling in what the whole rest of the story is. And it's just a wonderful moment when you're like, oh, I get it, all like locks into place for you. Like,
right.
What Andor's relationship with Marva is, how they met, how Andor got to be on Ferrix at all. Like all, why no one knows he's from Qunari, like all this stuff is just answered in that one scene. It's very satisfying narratively, I thought.
It is. And also you realize like, oh, this is, he's probably been looking for his sister for this entire amount of time
mm-hmm.
because that time when he leaves her with the group to go check out the crashed ship. And, you know, the last shot of episode 1 is the camera pulling away in this wide shot of his sister yeah. staying behind at the camp. And so this whole time, just because Marva takes him with her just to escape in time. So since he was probably, he looks like about like maybe 15 or so, he's probably been trying to find the little sister that he left behind.
Indeed. So that is the... Oh, go ahead.
There's one more thing that I want to mention. I'm trying to just find his name, but Marva's friend with her on the ship, is that Clem? I believe it's Clem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Clem Andor is played by Gary Beadle. Don't they mention in the present day in episode 3?
Weird that, that's probably why his name is Andor, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway,
exactly.
Go ahead.
I'm trying to see if, Fiona Shaw, if her name is, credited as Andor as well.
No, she's just Marva. She's just Marva.
Oh, no. Well, on IMDb, take that yeah. with a grain of salt, she's credited as Marva Andor.
Okay.
So maybe
so they're married then. They're not just friends.
It seems that way.
Yeah.
Or
they could be, yeah. I was going to say they could be brother and sister, but I don't think that makes sense. So they are I think they're married and Andor is their new child, basically. Their adopted child, right?
Gotcha. What I was going to say was, in the present day, in episode 3, don't they mention that he was killed?
I think that's right. I think that's right. I don't recall, though, like specifically that
moment. I believe
he
was like specifically like executed for something.
Oh, yeah. I don't think it's episode 3, though. I'm pretty sure it's like episodes 1 or 2 that's
maybe
revealed. Yeah.
I believe that is mentioned, but... and I'll go back and check. I will, you know, I don't think it is episode 2. I think it might be 3.
All right. Well, anyway,
we will confirm this by next episode of this show.
Yes. So anyway, that's the Qunari flashback stuff. Anything else you want to say about that before we move on?
No.
Okay.
Oh,
really, really awesome sequence, I thought.
Yeah.
All well done.
He's still in the present day. We see that he still has his kind of like staff blowgun thing in his bedroom next to a little Bantha toy. So
nice little, that's what we call, I believe in the business, an Easter egg.
That is, yeah. So some people I'm sure were so thrilled and relieved. It was like being in a desert and finding an oasis.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank God. A Bantha toy, something that reminds me of Tatooine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Andor wakes up on Ferrix. He has some flashbacks. He meets his friend Bix and he says, I have something to sell. An NS9 Starpath unit, Imperial seal still intact. This was just slightly confusing to me because I thought, did he get this off of those dudes that he just killed? But no, it's presumably something that he got like a long time ago. And then he reveals later on in episode 3 how he got it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's apparently something he's been hanging on to for a really long time to unload in just such an emergency as the one that he's in right now, right?
Yep.
Bix, we learn, is kind of having a relationship with her coworker Tim, who does not know anything about the relationship that Andor and Bix have. Bix agrees to contact her buyer, who we later learn is a character named Luthen, played by Stellan Skarsgård.
I got the impression that at some point Cassian and Bix probably dated or had mm-hmm. a thing.
Yeah.
And because Tim is clearly jealous,
yes.
of like anytime she's talking to Cassian, he's like watching them and not into this, and which becomes a major plot point. But yeah, nothing is ever said explicitly, but I just got the vibe that they had had a thing before, and now it's their relationship is mostly, you know, just like. Business transactions.
I didn't necessarily think they had a relationship, but I think that what is clear is I think Bix and Andor connect on a level that is different than Bix and Tim. I would say, honestly, the biggest weakness of these three episodes is the kind of Bix-Tim relationship, because Tim is so unlikable right from the get-go, like that his eventual death really didn't have that much of an impact on me. I know they try to fill it in. They have a little kind of, you know, tender moment between Bix and Tim when she comes back one night, but it didn't feel like that was the only one minor thing about the first three episodes that I was like, oh, not loving the Tim thing, because they, you know, they had to kill him off and they didn't really just have very much time to build that guy up before he does some terrible shit and they kill him, you know.
David, it's okay, you could admit that you just don't like Scottish people.
Thank you for giving me the space to do that.
Of course. But I don't think Tim is like, he's not like intensely unlikable, but he's just like, right away, you're just like, oh, he's like, you know, this is a guy who's just always like grumpily, like watching them, like, you mm-hmm. know, like, yeah. like from the background being like, like, you know, I don't like you, Cassian Andor, you know, get out of yeah. here. So also, you know, he's like hanging out at the bar. He's like maybe drinking a bit too much and making some questionable decisions, stuff like that. And never mind. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was going to say we also learn a few other things about Andor in the first couple episodes. Andor like owes people money. He meets a character named Vetch and Nurchi on the street that try to get money from him. He's swapping chip logs on the ship, and his guy says, you know, he says, I want to leave it better than I found it. And his friend says, the way you always do, the Cassian way. And you get the strong feeling that he's being sarcastic. Like, Cassian's kind of a mess up, it kind of seems. Like, he's not widely well-regarded. He's not, like, a widely respected person on Ferrix, is what I can tell, right?
Yeah, no, he's just... He's in debt. He's mooching off of everybody.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, he borrowed a ship to fly to Morlana One. Like, that wasn't his ship. He's like, he's broke all the time. I mean, he make like his whole income is just from like stealing stuff and then like reselling it.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's not especially good at what he does. And people don't seem especially fond of him. Like, they tolerate him, but he doesn't have, like, other... With the exception of... what's his name? Sorry, I'm looking it up. Brasso. His friend Brasso, the guy who works at the place with the gloves.
Yeah.
Brasso, it seems to be one of the only people who, like, actually likes Cassian and will help him out for reasons other than, like, business reasons.
Right, right. Well, you know, you bring up the gloves, and I actually think that's a great touch. I thought the way that Ferrix is depicted feels very lived in, feels very realistic, but the idea of the glove wall is an interesting one. Because I realized, like, oh, I've never seen anything like that before. And I think the implication of the glove wall is this is an extremely tight-knit community. Like, mm-hmm. everyone knows everyone. So the reason they could leave their work supplies up on the wall is because no one's going to steal them because everyone knows, like, everyone knows each other. And events later on reinforce this idea.
How tight-knit this community is, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And it's also, it's cool to see, like, a regular workplace. This is like kind of like a construction site or something.
Mining. They do mining as well, I think.
Yeah. But like, you know, it's like all, you know, everyone's going to work and they put on their work gear. And again, we don't tend to see a lot of that in Star Wars, just people with like blue collar jobs. But okay. Are we saving like deeper analysis until a little bit later? Because there's, I feel like the scene here is a really good example of I think one of the show's greatest strengths.
Which scene specifically?
The scene where Cassian goes and talks to Brasso.
Yeah, go ahead. That happens early on. So
yeah. So basically, because Cassian, knowing that, you know, last night he ended up killing some people, and this might cause complications, and so he goes and meets with his friend Brasso. Like when he gets off work and is just basically just like, hey, like please go along with the story I'm making up about us hanging out last night to give me an alibi for where I was if people end up asking about that. And it's a thing where without him saying explicitly like, hey, I'm in a tough situation, I need you to lie for me. He's just like basically just says like, hey, where were you last night? No. Here's what happened, and here's what we did, and here's the timeline of events. And then Brasso immediately starts like yes-anding him.
Yes.
And contributing more details to their like fictional story about the events of the past night. And what I think is what I really like about this show is that there are so many characters that are introduced over the course of these few episodes, and these are brand new characters to Star Wars. And in every case with these characters, every character has more going on and more, and feels like they have more of an internal life than we're used to. Like they have existing relationships with each other. There are characters who are jealous, or they are lazy, or they are like, you know, like frustrated with their jobs. They are they're like kind of greedy. They always have it's clear that these characters, like they want things, or they have like that they have actual feelings outside of just being like, I'm a crime boss and I do crime. And if you want, you know, to my help, you've got to give me money, which is, you know, that's not like a huge criticism, but that's how a lot of characters that we meet in Star Wars things often are. And here I'm just like, oh wow, these are like immediately like feel like three-dimensional characters who have lives, and we are jumping in and like they have existing relationships and everything, and just seeing like, oh, like Cassian and Brasso within like 30 seconds have like, oh, this is a rapport that they have that has been built up over years. And they have like a way of talking to each other that is like clearly like there is an actual friendship here. And it just, again, it feels like I'm praising a show for doing the bare minimum, but I don't think that it's that case. I think this is a show that is very good at immediately making every character feel like a human being, not just like a stock character, you know, designed to serve one purpose.
Yes. Agreed. At the same time, wow, we're praising a show for characters with internal lives, you know? But you take what you can get. You take what you can get.
Yeah. Because also, if Brasso were just like, you know, a one-dimensional cartoon who shows up for like one scene, we also wouldn't really be complaining about that. We'd just be like, oh, that's fine. But the fact that like, oh, this little character feels like he has more going on, It's like, that's not the bare minimum. That is going a little bit above and beyond.
Yeah. And I did love that interaction they have. And Cassian doesn't, I don't think he explains like what actually happened. He's just like,
he doesn't say anything about it. It's just, it's clear. Brasso can read between the lines that he's doing a favor because something happened last night that might be bad for Cassian, and he's going to help out his friend.
All right. What else happens in the first two episodes? Andor convinces Bix to call her guy, Luthen, Stellan Skarsgård, who shows up. There's like a bunch of scenes with Luthen showing up that I was just like, oh, these are just really like kind of color. They fill in the color of his visit to the planet. Like, he's on the bus with, like, he's on the space bus with this guy and just hanging out with the guy, and it's like, wow, okay. And I don't think we're ever going to see that character again, you know, like the guy he's talking to.
There are it's wild. It's a Star Wars show that has that has dialogue scenes and introduces characters just to kind of flesh out the world, and that are not just there to, like, for lore purposes.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, Cassian Andor does walk a lot. Matt Singer on Screen Crush wrote a whole, his review of the show is basically just about Cassian Andor walking and a list of all the parts where he walks. And I will say, in the first two episodes, I didn't think while watching, I was like, man, I think it's because they unlike the other Star Wars shows, which are largely shot using the volume, the ILM stagecraft technology with like the LED walls, on Andor, they built immense sets. Like, they basically built like several acres of Ferrix, of this city, to shoot on practically. And it almost, and a couple times, and this is a very minor complaint, I was kind of like, are they just really trying to get their money's worth and showing as many shots of Cassian walking down streets as possible just to put all the money on screen? Because, you know, it does show him walking from one place to another a lot.
Indeed. Indeed. But I didn't mind it. You know, he's a good looking, he's got a good gait.
He does. He has a cool
Diego
jacket.
Diego Luna. Yeah, cool jacket, got a good gait. So.
There's often fun little aliens in the background that I love to look at.
All right. I think that's most of Cassian's storyline until episode 3. But before
there is him, like, you know, once people start looking for someone who matches his description, there is like the scene where he talks to Marva, played by Fiona Shaw, for the first time, and she is just pissed at him because she's heard about the fact that you know, there's someone who is wanted for questioning, that is a male from Canary, and
they start running through all the people they know who might have told that he's from Canary. They're like Jezzy, Samo, etc. They have this whole list, probably some of who are on Wikipedia, you know, like,
right. But it's a thing where, because so she's basically like kind of his adoptive mother.
Yeah.
And it seems like he like does live with her most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she's just like, it's like there. In the scene where they interact for the first time, like in the present day, there's a sense that it's not. There's not a ton of warmth there. It is clear that she cares about him and his safety, but is also just immediately just mad that he messed up the rules, because they have a whole backstory they created about what planet he was actually born on. And somehow he screwed up and gave away to somebody his actual birthplace. And now it looks like their whole lives might come crumbling down. And again, I like this thing, like, right away. The first time these characters have a scene together, it without giving obvious exposition, they're communicating to the audience that okay, what their lives have been like, what their relationship is like, all of this stuff about like the rest of their lives. And I think it's good stuff. Also, Fiona Shaw is always very good.
Yeah, she's awesome.
I do wonder if she's going to appear in more than these. She's only in episodes 2 and 3. And I wonder, because Cassian does leave Ferrix at the end of episode 3. So I'm like, is that the end of her?
I would not be surprised if it was the end, because she's also like, it's a beautiful final shot for her. It's kind of like pulling out as she's weeping on the ashes of their broken household.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a good observation that there's not that much warmth there. That's, I felt that. I wasn't like, oh, this is like the loving mom who, like, you know, Cassian like really loves back and lots of warm feelings. I mean, I think because Cassian is kind of not the most successful dude who everyone reveres and admires and has made a mess of things, you can probably sense that the impact that that's had on Marva as well, right?
So yeah, also, I mean, look, she was like a scavenger. That was like her job, a scavenger, and then her husband, it seems like, got like captured and executed. Mm-hmm. So I imagine that they instilled Cassian with, I guess, skills to survive in difficult situations, right? But it's not like they were, you know, like it doesn't seem like it was a wonderful, loving household.
Indeed. All right. Before we move on, Patrick, let's take a quick break and talk about where people can find more of your work on the internet if they're enjoying this conversation.
Absolutely. So most of what I do on the internet is I make video essays that are usually about movies, and you can find those over at youtube.com/PatrickHWillems. That is the URL. I will say, in terms of Star Wars related stuff, I made my final Star Wars related video in February 2020. So if you want my feelings about Star Wars, you'll have to dig a little bit to go back there. And then I'm on the social media platforms at Patrick H. Willems.
All right. And I do just want to shout out that Decoding TV covers a lot of different shows. Right now we're covering She-Hulk with Siddhant Adlaka. We're covering The Rings of Power with Don Marshall. We also have a separate podcast called The Cast of Kings, covering House of the Dragon. Be sure to check all that stuff out at podcast.decodingtv.com or at castofkings.com. And if you want to support this show, decodingtv.com, become a paid member. That's how you can do that. I also want to give a shout out to the Episodic Medium podcast. Episodic Medium newsletter, which is a newsletter I consider essential to my online media consumption habits. A lot of former AV Club folks there writing about TV. Check it out at episodicmedium.substack.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
All right, Patrick, talk about the other plot lines in this episode, or these series of episodes.
Yeah.
Morlana 1, corporate security headquarters. Two men are dead, and Kravis is one of them. He's one of the most unpleasant people I've ever met, says Deputy Karn's boss. And there's this wonderful interaction between Karn and his boss where they kind of run through all the stuff that's happened. And the boss is like, honestly, amazing scene, because the boss puts the whole thing together in like 10 seconds. He like understands everything that goes on. But Deputy Karn will not be cowed. He's like, he's a young upstart. He does things by the book. And he's like, that could have easily been me that got killed on that planet. And I want to make sure we get to the bottom of this.
This is... the thing that I mentioned before about the scene with Brasso and these characters having more going on than we often encounter with a lot of Star Wars characters, this was really the scene where I kind of sat up and went, oh, wow, I've never seen a scene quite like this in Star Wars. Like, we've seen lots of scenes of Imperial officers, like, you know, talking about Imperial things and following orders and stuff like that. But here we have two people who are working, I guess, in an Empire adjacent thing. It's like a, you know, a security company that it seems like they were contracted by the Empire to do things. But you have these two employees, and one of them, he does figure out, like the boss, like he have a sense of what happened, but is also just like, I don't like this guy. He sucked. This seems like it would be a big headache. Let's just kind of brush it under the rug and move on with our lives and not make a big deal about it, which is not a thing we usually see like Imperial folks doing. And then we have Karn, who is...
I mean, we saw a little bit of it in Rogue One, where Krennic is a middle manager type person who's trying to, like, you know, manipulate his superiors into getting the outcome that he wants. But
exactly, and but it's also, but usually,
it's not usually like that. In
right, and again, I love Krennic. Krennic is like maybe my favorite character in Rogue One, because we're not used to seeing these middle manager type people. And then, and Andor doubles down on the like complicated middle manager type people, because then you have, it's Karn, right?
Yeah.
And then Karn, who is like, the vibe I get from him is Gareth on the British Office, who became Dwight in the American Office, which is the kind of person who's like, they're kind of a loser and don't have a lot of friends, and get this office job and just have like this like really unearned loyalty toward the company, and kind of put all their energy into just being like, look, we have to put the company first, and I am here for, this is the team that I'm on, and I want to do a really good job, and I'm very excited about this tiny little bit of power that I have, and I want to just like get like follow that like as hard as I can, and like I, because I want to be the, like, my ultimate dream in life is to be the boss at this company I work for. And that's the vibe I get from Karn, where it's like everyone around him doesn't seem to, like, all his coworkers just seem to put up with him, and he's just very concerned that two employees of the company were killed, and he's going to go all in on this one thing and just figuring this out, because it's his one chance to feel powerful and like get to order people around. Because then eventually in episode two, sorry to skip ahead slightly, but when he's like there with actual people who are, you know, they're going on the mission down to Ferrix, and he's there with people who are actually like trained soldiers, or actually like have like firearms and stuff like that. And he's put in a spot to give like a speech kind of to the troops, and it's so pathetic. And all he can do is just like rehash like inspiring aphorisms he's heard before, and no one is taking him seriously. And I'm just like, I never see this kind of person in Star Wars. And this guy, again, he, as a person, he sucks so much, but he's such an interesting, weaselly little character. And I want to watch. So I hope he continues for like the whole season, because he's so interesting.
I'm going to put this out there, Patrick. I think you're great stuff on Karn. Cyril Karn is his first name. Oh,
what a good name.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that you're being a little bit hard on him, okay? Because I actually think that the show makes him slightly sympathetic. Let me say a couple things. First of all, my favorite line from their first interaction was when he says, his boss says to him, like, we want to minimize the time the Empire spends thinking about Preox Morlana. That's what he says. Anyone who's ever been in a corporate environment, and I have for like a decade, knows that that is something that a lot of people want to do. When you're presenting with the bosses or whatever, minimize the time they need to spend thinking about what you're doing, because ideally you're taking care of everything. Everything's under control, and they don't need to be like, what's going on with this? What's going on? You know, like, because if they're doing that, then it means they're not happy with something. So
right.
You want to minimize. And if you're like, there's been a murder, we're going to blah, 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 you know, then it's like, okay, now they're all up in your stuff. Let's make all of our lives easier. Let's minimize the time. Okay. I do think that the show goes to great pains, Patrick, to establish that there are other people sympathetic with Karin's position. Sergeant Linus Mosk shows up later on. Also a great name. And like everyone just has the perfect name for what they look like and what their character does in this show.
It's right? True.
And Linus Mosk shows up and, you know, he and Karin have a conversation and Karin's like, yeah, I wanted to get going on this as fast as possible. And, you know, Linus is like, I agree. We need to take a stronger hand with these planets that we're, you know, like there is yes, Karin is a douchebag. And if he was in the office, he'd be the most annoying person there. A lot of Tracy Flick energy emanating off of Karin.
Can I also add that he, on his own, modified his uniform and did some slight tailoring on it and like adjusted like the color piping on it because that is how seriously he takes his job.
Yes. But I think that we are meant to at least a tiny bit sympathize that, hey, this guy's just had some of his coworkers murdered. And he wants to get to the bottom of it. And yes, he is a very annoying person in the service of that. But there was a tiny part of me that was like, oh, this is just a guy trying to do the right thing. You could easily see a movie, Patrick, that's told from his perspective where he is the good guy.
Oh, absolutely. You know?
That's what I'm saying.
I think this is what makes him so compelling.
Yeah.
Because the thing is,
You were really hard on him just now. So
I was really hard on him. Well, because it's the thing. I think that, you know, this reaction about like his coworkers being murdered does largely come from his intense loyalty toward the company and being like you know, anything bad happens to anyone at the company, you know, like this is my team, and so it's almost less them being like people who were murdered and more like the company was dishonored and and we need to do what is right. But it's like, again, he's like kind of a pathetic character. And so I kind of pity him a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
And I was hard on him because, you know, like you said, if we encountered him in real life, we would not want to spend much time with him.
Right.
I just think he's very interesting. And I think his reasons for doing what he does and going all in on trying to like solve this case are less about him caring about human life and more about him caring about the corporation.
Fair enough. Well, let's get to episode 3, Patrick. I'll just start by saying I'm really glad they released these first 3 episodes at a time. I think you were right on when you said the boundaries between episodes felt fairly arbitrary. Like
I think off mic before we started
maybe
recording.
but I think it would have been fairly unsatisfying if they just released like episode 1 by itself. You know, these 3 episodes really feel like they form a 3 episode arc. Like they are like their own standalone movie. If this was the entirety of Andor, like just these 3 episodes, I'd actually feel like, oh, that was pretty cool, like, you know. But anyway, go ahead.
And I agree. I mean, they definitely made the right call releasing the 3 together because the first 2 episodes, while I think they're compelling and I like the characters and stuff like that, they are fairly slow. They're mostly, you know, characters talking in their homes and stuff like that. There isn't like it really takes until episode 3 for like to get some like a huge jolt of energy in the show. Episodes 1 and 2 are a lot of like laying the groundwork and all of that. And I was a little concerned when episode 1 ended and it just kind of ends with like all the threads going. There's no, it felt kind of like they shot episodes 1 and like it, the vibe I got when episode 1 ended, I was like, is this going to be one of those situations, you know, like every Netflix show where, oh, it's a 12-hour movie and they just kind of split them in random places. And because it's a thing that a lot of people are frustrated with. But having seen the first 3 episodes, what I really like about this, and then also having read, you know, stuff that Tony Gilroy has said about it, is that even if the like episode, if like the dividing lines between like episodes 1 and 2 and 2 and 3 are a little bit arbitrary, like they just kind of stop and then pick up again in the next one, the 3 episodes together are like such a contained arc that like there is an ending to episode 3. And then it really seems like 4 through 6 will be their own thing. They will function as these units.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So I like, you know, the first 3 episodes are kind of like one giant size episode. And it does actually feel like a satisfying story is told across those 3. And so that really made up for my initial, uncertainty about the episode structure there. But episode 3, things are really kick in.
Yeah. I thought episode 3 was amazing.
It's really good.
It just the pacing of it, the way it ramps up the score, the sound design of it was just really, really good. And so it's basically the men on Ferrix are like the ship shows up from Morlana, and it's an awesome shot when it like comes out of light speed, and then like immediately, like literally a split second after it comes out of light speed, like it starts deploying these shuttles onto the surface. And the whole episode is basically what happens when these corpos in this universe start occupying the land that they are supposed to be in charge of, and catastrophic things ensue. By the way, in the Andor universe, ACAB stands for All Corpos Are Bastards. I thought that was something that I think comes through in the episodes.
It's true. So,
yeah.
And also, Stellan Skarsgård's character does say bastards several times.
Yeah.
Also, a thing that I want to point out, because we haven't mentioned him by name, Toby Haynes directed the first 3 episodes, and I believe directs a few other episodes later in the season. David, are you familiar with Toby Haynes's directing work?
A little bit. Didn't he do some Black Mirror?
I think he did one episode. I think it was it the USS Callister episode?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Because I've been a fan of Toby Haynes ever since he did a like 5-episode run of Doctor Who. He did like the 2-part finale to season 5, which I think is the best season of Doctor Who. Then the Christmas special, and then the opening 2 episodes for season 6. And I back then, this was like 2010 and 2011, I was so struck by how well directed those episodes were, and just the sense of scale that he brought to a show that was often, you know, considered like a little janky and cheap. And it felt like him coming on and directing those episodes felt like a huge upgrade to just the visual presentation of the show. And right away I was like, okay, I need to remember this name, because I think this guy is one of the best TV directors I've seen come along in a while. I've been wondering, like, when is he going to get hired to like make a movie or something? And I saw other TV stuff he did over time, but I was so excited when he was announced to be doing Andor, because I was already looking forward to the show, and I was like, okay, this guy doing Star Wars, I think he's going to be really good for this. And in these episodes, as much as there are like visual similarities to like the general aesthetic of Rogue One, like a lot more like handheld stuff, like very naturalistic lighting, the kind of thing that, you know, like Greg Fraser and Gareth Edwards established there. We've highlighted so many really good directing choices over like in our discussion so far. And I really think he like has kind of raised the bar for the Star Wars television. Like, having seen all the live action Star Wars TV so far, I think this is the best directed stuff that I've seen.
Awesome. Certainly I think he's super talented after watching this set of episodes, and episode 3, I just think is a high watermark. It begins when these guys, the Corpo, show up on the planet, but then basically the tension escalates as things slowly spiral out of control. They show up at Marva's house, and they kind of take her aside, and then you hear Andor calling in on the B2 EMO droid, and they use that comms link to kind of detect his location. I do want to say, I think that is a Rogue One reference, because in Rogue One, there's also a scene where Andor calls K2SO in the, like when they're at Scarif, and his voice comes through the droid again. So I was like, right. I wonder if that's a Rogue One reference. Anyway,
you'd think he'd have learned from this this instance not to do it.
Well,
again.
I don't think anything bad happened as a result of the latter instance, though. But I think it was a similar situation where his voice goes through it. Anyway, and then at the same time as that's happening, Andor is encountering Luthen, and they have a whole conversation in this like really coolly designed warehouse hangar thing with all this stuff hanging above that becomes useful for the action scene later.
Yeah.
And it's really a cool conversation, because you learn, like, everyone's kind of playing poker with each other, and they're like, what do you know? What do I know? And it comes out essentially that Luthen wants to recruit Andor whoever, and he wants to recruit Andor and/or whoever is behind Andor, the guy. Because, yeah, go ahead.
They named the character Andor just to create awkward sentences like this one.
Yes, indeed. And he's like, I don't know if you're the guy who stole this unit, or you are representing him, or you're with him, but like, I'm looking for the guy who like stole the unit. And then it's a really cool conversation where he says, you know, how did you steal it? I'll give you another 1,000 credits.
He has so much money to throw around.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll give you another 1,000 credits. And he's like, I just walk in and people, they don't even care. They are so arrogant. They think no one could possibly walk in and just take things out from under them. It's a great scene of dialogue, and it's obviously like
really
very, I think it's going to be very thematically resonant with what the show is trying to say about occupiers and their arrogance and like how that all plays out. It's awesome. This is what the stuff is. At the same time as that, it's like intercutting between that and like things escalating like outside of the warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big action scene that happens in the warehouse. Pretty good action scene, you know.
Well, the move where Stellan Skarsgård, or Luthen, reveals that he had rigged an explosive charge on the entrance. So he's all set for like, oh, if they come in after me, I'm going to blow them up. Good.
It's amazing. And he just like does it so nonchalantly. Like, well, Arnold Schwarzenegger in True Lies, like, here's my invitation. Like, kaboom. Like,
yes,
it's amazing.
And what's also fun about this is the stuff that you just mentioned with Cassian, you know, talking about, you know, the arrogance of these of the people who run everything, that like they never expect that someone like me can just stroll in and steal from them. But it's interesting because like Cassian obviously, you know, hates these occupying forces, does not like the Empire and stuff like that, but he has not been on any crusade to like to stop them or do anything to them. He's just trying to survive here. And seeing him get brought into the rebellion this way, of just Luthen just kind of like, it almost kind of reminds me of like the early scenes in Men in Black with Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith. The older person like looking like at this younger person being like, oh, they have the right skills and kind of the right attitude to like be very useful, even though they don't really know that the thing I'm from exists or what it is at all. And watching this, watching this develop and watching like how he gets brought in. He basically gets brought into the rebellion just because he wants to get away, just like because it's kind of a way out of a bad situation. And again, I like it because we're used to Star Wars being like pretty simple about being like, yeah, like there's the big evil fascist bad guys, and we're going to join the fight against them because it's the right thing to do. And I like that it's all a bit more complicated here.
Well, you're saying it's born out of self-interest in this scene.
Yes.
Right. But later on, I think it will go beyond self-interest.
Yeah.
Also, like in terms of the action scene that happens, kind of a cool like the stuff falling down from the ceiling, cool concept. Also just like the cool idea of, hey, there's this extremely valuable box that is like back towards the entrance, and like Andor really wants to get it.
Mm-hmm.
you know, it's very minor blocking decision of like they walk to one side of the room, the box is on the other side of the room, and then like all of a sudden all hell breaks loose on the other side, you know. But it creates a sufficient amount of tension that I quite enjoyed the scene.
Yeah.
Also, the NS9 Starpath unit can track every Imperial coordinate for 9 parsecs. Apparently, that's why it's so.
You looked that up, didn't you?
No, I just recalled it instantly. But also, like, what's interesting is that. Like he's like, how do I know it works? And he's like, well, if you plug it in, it instantly loses value. It's like a Star Wars action figure, basically. Right. Like if you take the wrapping off, like you can, it's no longer untraceable anymore.
Right.
Which I thought was a fine touch. So anyway, okay. So they get out, and what is awesome about this whole sequence is, this like they start like banging. You know, all the townspeople start like banging on metal stuff in the background, like this rhythmic fashion. And we also didn't mention on Ferrix, like at the beginning of every workday or whatever, there's a guy that goes up
at
to that
the
tower
end.
And like, and no, it's like every workday, I think.
Yeah, but
he does it multiple times.
Yeah, well, he does it at the beginning and the end of the day.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he kind of bangs on this gigantic, like gong style unit metal thing that creates this noise. And so they're very into the banging on metal things in Ferrix, I think is kind of what we learned.
And I mean, like when they introduce the gong guy, it's the kind of thing that I love where it's just like right away, like pretty quickly, they're just fleshing out like the culture of this place. Like this is one of their kind of like daily rituals.
Yeah.
And it just, again, it makes the place feel more lived in.
Agreed. But I just love the, what a great system, you know, like, and it's like, it is very intimidating and very unsettling. And it's not like, what are these guys going to do about it? They can't like arrest every single person that's doing it because there's like hundreds of them that are
right.
So it's like, doesn't make any sense. So it's like a smart system for fighting back. And then basically at one point, like just cool badass thing after cool badass thing happens like in a row, that it's so much stuff that I'm like, I'm barely processing what just happened that was awesome, and now there's another awesome thing that's going on. But it starts with them like Andor basically getting the drop on Cyril Karn, right? And he's like, how many people are with you? And Karn's like, I don't know. And then you know, Luthen's like, okay, I'm just going to kill this guy. And Karn's like, okay, there's like 12 of us, which is like a really like no. He's given them, you know, important information that's going to compromise his men now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they decide to not kill him. They tie him up so he can like live to see the humiliation. There's a guy that accidentally kills Tim, and they're like, oh, we got to cover this up. Get on the ship and get out of here. And then you see that his friend, what's his name? Brazo?
Brazo, yeah.
Has attached a gigantic piece of metal to the ship. And so he like takes off and he can't take off. And then the piece of metal gets caught in something and the ship like swings to the side and explodes.
It's great.
And then
and also, because they just planted the seed for that, because we knew Brazo worked at this kind of like mining construction place. And so, and they're basically right at his workplace. So it's like totally within the skill set they've established.
Totally. And also like you see that Brazo has like, has said goodbye to Andor. He knows that these dudes are looking for Andor. Right. And so he's trying to help his buddy out. And then Mosk, like, it was almost comical because Mosk like turns and he looks, he's like, oh my gosh, are they behind us? They must be surrounding us right now. And it's just like literally like three dudes that have done like all the damage that he's talking about. And then of course the sort of final sequence that happens is, a self-driving vehicle takes off down the street. And they blow it up, and then
speeder, David.
Okay, fair enough. And all the corpos crowd around it, and then, like, Stellan Skarsgård's Luthen, always really good with the explosives. He, like, swings by on another. What is that called? I thought that was...
Okay, a speeder is, like, the car.
The thing. Car,
you
know, yeah.
Or the land speeder. Like the one that Luke has in episode 4. And then they're on a speeder bike.
That's on episode 6, basically, right?
Yes.
Similar to episode 6, right. So, and they whiz by on a speeder bike, and then Stellan Skarsgård detonates the car, and it kills multiple corpos on the way. And it's like this... big cathartic moment of like, this is the end of the action scene that's been building up for like the last like 20, 30 minutes. And you really just get a sense of like, Karn is just completely effed because he was not even supposed to be investigating this at all. Now he's gotten several of his own men killed because of his own incompetence. And did you not feel any sympathy for Karn in that moment, Patrick Willems?
a little bit. I mean, again, as a pathetic figure where I'm just like, this guy is not even very good at what he does. Like,
yeah,
again, in his quest to feel a small sense of power.
Yes.
Look what he did.
Yeah.
Because he thought they were just going to arrest one guy, and he mostly just got unlucky because he ended up in a situation with like what seems like a rebellion leader who's like very skilled, who's both very rich and also very skilled with like guerrilla combat tactics.
Yeah.
It's
as you do sometimes it happens. Who among us hasn't had that happen before?
I mean, it's been a while for me, but yeah, we've all been there. I will say, I also just really liked when the speeder bike is escaping as they're heading back to Skarsgård's ship. Just the like the aerial shots that show us a bit more of Ferrix and just like like the what seems like farming fields and just like it's this. We all love to see more of the worlds in Star Wars.
Yeah, yes,
and this stuff it fills it out a little bit more. Just like the care put into the design of like these like 4 second shots. I love it.
I am looking forward to the scene next episode. I assume when Karn is going to get his comeuppance for his terrible decisions. That's going to be awesome. Like I want to see Karn meeting his boss again. That's going to be an amazing scene. I hope.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I just want more Karn. I'm just like, it's a thing that I'm very curious about is because a lot of the like behind the scenes material and interviews about the show have talked about, you know, the huge sets they built for like the city on Ferrix, and it seems like we might be done with Ferrix now, and so I'm wondering like. Man, if they built all of that for like 25% of the season. And I was also thinking when I was rewatching episode one, I was like, I'm guessing that the opening scene of the first episode on Morlana 1, that was redressed sets from Ferrix. Like there's a part where Andor is like walking down some steps down a street. And there's also steps in like a Ferrix one. I was like, just thinking logically about like, Disney has a lot of money and this is an expensive show, but I'm just like, you know, like there's still efficient ways to do this. And I was thinking like, they probably redressed the sets for that. And so I'm curious, like, what are we going to see next? Are there going to be other cities where they built like 3 acres worth of streets for it? Because, they're not, I'm sure there's a little bit on there, but like they're not just using LED wall backgrounds for every single scene like the other shows. And so I just want to see what locations we're going to see next. Because we're into the next like story arc. Starting next week.
Indeed. A couple of other things I want to mention. I do think the shell shock that Karn is experiencing at the end of the episode is really palpable. Like he just has this look on his face like, Joe Bluth, I've made a huge tiny mistake. You know, like he's just really... And his Linus Mosk needs to be like, dude, we got to get out of here. And he's like, he doesn't even know what to do at that point. It's amazing, right?
Linus is also, I feel like I didn't talk enough about him, an incredible character, another Scotsman.
100%, yeah.
And that's a guy who's more experienced and better at his job than Karn is. Like has, you know, actually knows how to like lead a battalion.
Yeah.
But also seems like very eager to, he seems like he just wants to shoot people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like Karn wants to order people around in the office. Linus wants to like be outside and to like hold people up at gunpoint.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Linus Mosk, played by Alex Ferns, who is recently seen as Commissioner Pete Savage in Matt Reeves' The Batman.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yes. That
I think he was the guy that like got like, his face was going to get eaten by rats in The Batman, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes.
So, yeah.
He's the guy who has the one F-bomb in The Batman. Who
oh,
says,
nice.
Happy
yeah.
effing
yeah.
Halloween to
yeah.
The Batman. Yeah, he like delivers the speech to the like the press conference after the mayor is murdered.
Yeah,
wow, and he has an American accent there.
Yeah, got a lot of range. So
yeah, well, hey, anyway. This is the thing. All these like big American productions shooting in the UK.
Yeah, the episode of Andor, episode 3 ends. The music is swelling. We get a glimpse of each character, basically boom, 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 like montage of like every single character, and where they are. Bix is very upset about Tim's death. I thought the scene with Marvo was very beautiful. You know, like kind of she's crying and understands that her life with Andor is probably over at this point. And there is a moment when Andor is on the ship, and it cuts back and forth between Andor seeing the sunlight from when he was a child on Canary and Marva was taken off. And now he is from Ferrix with this other dude taken off. And basically like both of these characters in his life showing him what his future is going to be. And I thought that was a nice little visual parallel there.
So, yeah.
Anyway, a lot of great stuff. Like great. At the end, I was like, I'm satisfied. That was like a very satisfying 3 episodes of the show.
Definitely. So. Also, as you were saying that, I'm wondering, did we actually talk about Tim reporting Cassian and like
we mentioned how traitorous Tim was as and annoying, but we didn't mention that he actually reported him, which was like, wow, you really hate that character.
And
you know?
That really seemed to come down to him like following Bix, seeing her meet Cassian at a bar, drinking a bit himself, and then being like, I'm gonna go report this guy. And so he gets shot by the very people that he sent the report to.
Yeah.
It's also, I want to say, it's interesting watching a Star Wars thing where it's not just faceless stormtroopers as like the bad
right.
guys in these shootouts. Just watching
right.
like, you know, human beings, it's just having faces on the people in the,
yeah.
these shootouts. It's just, it's kind of like a new little wrinkle.
Refreshing.
Yeah.
Refreshing. But yeah, I think it's to show, you know, the idea is to show you that, hey, like loyalty is not rewarded in the Empire or the corpo version of the Empire. Right.
Right.
With Tim. And also, like Tim is ultimately a subject, you know, he's ultimately, a part of an occupied territory, and he will be treated as such no matter how much useful information he provides.
Well, a thing that I actually do want to say, are we considering Ferrix an occupied territory? Because I would think of an occupied territory as like Jeddah in Rogue One, where there's just like full, like, you know, there's like a Star Destroyer hovering inside the atmosphere. They're like mining Kyber there. There are stormtroopers in the streets. This feels to me like just an ordinary planet that's just
well,
there.
Well, here's what you're right, because it doesn't seem like there's a ton of corpos there.
Right.
In general, right?
I mean,
and in fact, one of the people says it's been a while since we've seen any like blue suits or whatever he calls corpos.
Right. right?
Sergeant Linus Mosk says, quote, we need a stronger hand, or this might not be an exact quotation, but he basically says we need a stronger hand with these outer planets. Corporate tactical forces are the Empire's first line of defense. So that's what he says. So maybe like technically they belong to the Empire, or they're under the control of the Empire. But maybe they kind of, my sense is they kind of let them do their own thing most of the time.
Right. I mean,
that's kind
like,
of my sense. Yeah.
I think the Empire generally rules over everything.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of planets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a lot of planets, not that many forces. And I love that this is a show that's actually like really in-depth exploring what it actually means for the Empire to rule everything, right? Like you can't have a Darth Vader on every planet, you know, like you can't have an Emperor on every planet, but you can have these corpos.
Exactly.
Visiting planets. You can have corpos visiting planets sometimes. That's kind of what you can get.
Yes. And it also feels like the Galactic Civil War that the original trilogy is about has not really gotten started yet. Like, it seems like Luthen is, you know, like in the early stages of the rebellion. He's yes. like, he's like a rich guy who's like, you know, gathering resources and funds and stuff, but it doesn't yeah. seem like there is an active war happening right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I suspect we'll find out, but yeah, I think we're probably going to see it develop through the course of the show. So
yeah.
Exciting stuff. Exciting stuff. Anything else, Patrick Willems?
I don't think so. I'm okay. just, you know, I said in the last episode why I, agreed to do the podcast with you, that I was optimistic about this show, and I feel like you will feel similarly here. It's really nice to see that our optimism was rewarded, that it yes. is genuinely the fresh, exciting show to kind of like revitalize our interest in Star Wars.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, you can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us. Let us know what you thought of the first three episodes at decodingtv@gmail.com. And if you want to support the show, you can go to decodingtv.com, become a paid member. You get early episodes, ad-free episodes, and bonus episodes whenever we can record them. Patrick Willems, thanks so much for chatting with me today, man. Really appreciate it.
David Chen, pleasure as always. Thank you so much for you know, for asking me to do this show. I'm excited to spend the next couple months doing this.
Indeed. We'll see you next week for another episode of Decoding TV covering Andor.
Thanks for listening. Goodbye.